Our first reading is very short, and I think you lose something because of that. So bear with me. I'm going to back up a little bit and set the stage for this story, because this is one of the most incredible stories in the Old Testament. I have to admit, it is my personal favorite. And hopefully, by the time I get through, you'll understand why it is my favorite. So we have Elijah. Now, Elijah has been running for his life because he not only made the queen Jezebel angry, but he basically led to the demise of her 850 personal prophets of Baal and Ashtaroth. So, where did this all come from? Her husband was Ahab, who was the son of Omen, who is the son of, I forget at this point, and was the son of Jehoiada, who all four of them were, each one was more rotten than the predecessor. And by the time of Ahab, because of Jezebel, who was not Jewish, but Sidonian, she, when he married her, she was, let us say, a rather strong figure, and he wasn't, and so she pretty much controlled him. And she brought with her the worship of Baal. And in fact, because of her, he started setting up temples to Baal, even in Jerusalem. Now, what was so bad about him? He totally forgot the covenant with God, strayed from everything, and the ultimate worst thing of idolatry, but in the name of idolatry, they were doing child sacrifice. So they were killing children, offering them to Baal, and sometimes, depending on the version of the Baal cult, they were doing it while the children were alive. They were throwing them in the fire. So this was how bad it was. And she had killed all of the prophets in Israel except Elijah. So Elijah is called by God to do something about this. And so there's this meeting, and they have what I like to call a prophet off. Who's the best prophet? So it's a great story, chapter 18, I believe it is. You read that story, and it is. It's what you should go read it. So I'll give you the short version. So they gather together all these prophets, her 450 prophets of Baal and her 400 prophets of Ashtaroth. And so Elijah's there, says, and the people of Israel gather, and he says, okay, whoever's God can come down and with fire consume the offering that we make is the true God. And the people said, okay, we'll buy that. So he says, well, you got more of them, so you better get started first. So they get their bullock and they slaughter it, and they, you know, now part of the Baal cult is they're slashing themselves and they're chanting and they're wanting her in this. As they're losing blood, they get into a frenzy. And they're really sort of out of mind at that point. And so Elijah's standing there, and as the sun, so they started in the morning at sunup, and this is becoming noon, and nothing's happening. Baal hasn't come down to consume their bullock. So Elijah stands and says, well, you know, he's a god, maybe he's off vacationing, or maybe he's asleep, you need to get his attention. And so they even gash themselves more and then go into a bigger frenzy. And then finally the time period for the offering is over. So then Elijah takes his bullock, slaughters it, builds an altar with 12 stones for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he properly prepares the bullock. And then he tells the assistants, go get 3 big stones, you know, like 40-gallon stone jugs of water, and pour it on it. And pour it on the wood, and go get 3 more, and pour it on again, and pour it on a third time. So everything is soaked, the trench is full of water around it, and then he prays. And he prays to God, and he says, oh God, you who have loved your people, give them this sign. And his fire comes down, consumes the bullock, the wood, the stones, the water. And then Elijah says, okay, people of Israel, who's God? We know. Kill the prophets. And so all 850 of them are killed. Now, it's pretty brutal. But this is exactly what they were doing to innocent people. So while it's really harsh in Old Testament understanding, it was justified. Well, needless to say, Jezebel was not happy about this. These were her pet prophets. And so she stirs up her husband Ahab to get the entire army of Israel to start chasing Elijah. So the next part of the chapter is him chasing all over the country with them following him. He's about ready to give up. He's just like, he's worn out. And he lays down and he says, "Lord, let me die now." And he falls asleep, and then a messenger comes and says, "Yo, get up. Eat, drink." And he goes back to sleep again. And the messenger says, "No, get up. You got a long way to go yet. You're not ready. You're not done." And he realizes it was an angel of God. And so he eats and he drinks. And then he goes on a 40-day hike through the desert and ends up on the mountain that we hear today, the mountain of Horeb, the mountain of God, the mountain where Moses encountered God. And so he goes up and he's in this cave. And this is his last chance. The armies are down there looking for him. And first there's the big wind. Now Baal was supposed to be the god of wind and rain. And there's a whole other story about that, but I'm not going to go into that today. Baal obviously was bogus. So he's up there and this big wind comes and he realizes that's not God. So then there's an earthquake and he realizes that's not God. And then there's fire. And it's not God. And then he hears this soft little sound. And what we don't really get in the full story is he comes out of the cave, at the mouth of the cave, and he takes his cloak and puts this over his face because he believed if he saw God passing, he would die. That was their understanding. And God passes by. And then God says to him, "So what are you waiting for? Get back with being a prophet." That's the short version. Let me come to the gospel and I'm going to try to put the two together. So we have Jesus has fed the crowds. You know, depending on whose account you go by, it was 3,000 or 5,000, whatever. It was a large crowd. And so he sends the disciples ahead of him. "You go get in the boat and I'll meet you there." He needed some time alone. He goes and he prays. We find this throughout the Gospels, that Jesus takes time to pray, to be still. He who was the Son of God takes time to talk to the Father. When he's done, he goes out, and the disciples are having a hard time of it because the wind is against them. And apparently the storms on the Lake Genezareth could be very violent. And so even though they're fishermen, they're afraid. It's the middle of the night. The fourth watch is between 12 and 3 a.m., I believe. And they're frightened. And they see him, and they're like, "Okay, this is not normal. Is this Jesus? Is this the devil coming to tempt us? What is it?" And he comes up to them. And they say it's a ghost, and he says, "No, it is I." And so Peter, you know, good old Peter, he usually talks before he thinks. But he has a great heart. He really does. So Peter says, "Oh Lord, call me to come out and walk on the water with you." So Jesus says, "Okay, come on, Peter." And what happens? 1, 2, 3. "Oh, help me, help me." Jesus reaches and pulls him up. Very important gesture. And then suddenly they're in the boat. And the storm stops. Now, if the other disciples weren't a little bit rattled, they are now. Because here is another manifestation. He just fed the how many thousand with, you know, a couple loaves and fishes. And now he walks across the sea and the storm winds obey him. He is showing the power of the Father, who is God creator over all the universe. But he shows it in compassion and in a way that they can accept. And he doesn't chide Peter except to say, "Why did you doubt?" All he does is ask him the question. "It's I." And this is the question that he's constantly asking us. Why do we doubt? And this is where we bring the two stories together. there's sort of two things. One is, how do we encounter God? We're in a society where we want everything to be stadium fireworks and big blast and so on, and we expect God to do that. And this is exactly what Elijah was expecting. Because Moses had all that, and he was on the mountain of Moses. Well, Moses had all that, and a whole different thing happened. But for Elijah, that was not how he encountered God. He encountered God in quietness, in stillness, the same way Jesus encountered the Father when he went off by himself up the mountain and prayed, when he was in the garden and he went away from the disciples and he prayed with his own doubts, "Father, if this cup may be taken away from me, let it be so, but if not, your will be done." This is how we encounter God. Not in the big sounds. I don't think he generally comes to us in big events. I think God is constantly trying to communicate to us in the small things. But because of our cultural dimension and advertising and everything else, we don't listen to the small things. And then we wonder why we don't hear God. Because we don't know how to be still enough to hear that soft whisper that is God's Spirit. We need to do like Jesus sometimes and go off alone and be still. Prayer is both. It is at times very individual, and it needs to be where we are listening more than we are talking. And then there is prayer that we do in common, where we together hear and together speak. Both are needed. It can't be one or the other. So why this is so important to me? Because it's a reminder to me that that's where God speaks. And particularly when we're in greatest difficulty. When we have probably less likelihood to try to listen, that's exactly when he's trying to talk to us. In the times when it's most difficult. When we're struggling. When we have doubts. He's saying, "Why do you doubt? It is I am here." But if we're so, you know, our minds are going and, "Oh my God, this and that, no, I have to do this and that, and everything's happening and it's terrible," we don't hear him, all we hear is our own voice. We need to let ourselves be like those waters where he sends his hands out upon them and they become still, so that our hearts may be still and we may hear him speak his love to us. "I love you, and you are mine, and I am with you always to the end of time."